This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we've got a special program devoted entirely to the economy. Is Wall Street in crisis, or more broadly, is the capitalist system in crisis? We have Rick Wolf, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts.
One question we've asked is, what can be done? Do we go back to a more of a Keynesian model and trickle down some more wealth to the working class, or do we need something more revolutionary? Hear what they think on Law and Disorder.
The terrorist Luis Posada Carriles remains free on the streets of Miami. Today we'll bring you excerpts from a recent discussion at New York University School of Law on Posada's crimes.
This guy blew up a plane with 73 people on it, including the entire young Cuban fencing team. He attempted to blow up an auditorium with 2,000 people in it. This longtime CIA employee is being coddled by this government and not sent back to Venezuela, where he should be tried for crimes against humanity.
For the first time in American history, beginning this month, the 1st Brigade Combat Team of the 3rd Infantry Division will be under daily control of Northern Command, or NORTHCOM, an on-call federal response force for natural or man-made emergencies and disasters, including terrorist attacks. This decision to permanently deploy a U.S. Army brigade inside the United States for domestic law enforcement violates prohibitions in the long-standing Posse Comitatus Act. This is also the first active unit that has been put under control of the Department of Homeland Security. In an Army Times article, several paragraphs reference why a seasoned combat Army unit is being deployed domestically. One sentence reads, quote, "They may be called upon to help with civil unrest and crowd control, or to deal with potentially horrific scenarios, such as massive poisoning and chaos, in response to a chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, or high-yield explosive attack. To many, this is a first step of abuse of an important democratic safeguard." Today, we're joined by Steve Fox with the American Freedom Campaign Action Fund. Welcome, Steve, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi and Michael, for having me.
Now, before we get into the details of what's happening with this new plan, can you describe what a brigade is?
As I understand it, about 3,000 to 4,000 soldiers.
Yeah, it's headed up by a brigadier general, a one-star general. And in this instance, the brigade that they want to bring from Iraq to the United States to patrol our streets is a brigade that I understand was a combat brigade in Iraq. They fought in Baghdad. They fought in Fallujah. What's going on here?
What's happening now is, for the first time in our history, the Bush administration is positioning them to do what they do on U.S. soil. And there have been federal laws in existence for 200 years that prohibited this. And these laws have prevented U.S. soldiers from acting in basically a domestic law enforcement capacity.
What's wrong with the Army acting in a domestic law enforcement capacity? Why did the founding fathers and people during the 19th century, why was this always opposed? What do you think is wrong with having an Army come here to patrol our streets?
And once you do this, there's almost no limit to what the federal government could do. I mean, they can go in. I mean, this brigade, which is being trained to act in quelling civil unrest and being trained in crowd control. I mean, as you know, Naomi Wolf, who I've been working with the American Freedom Campaign, she's mentioned, and there's a lot to it, that we have an election coming up, and it could turn out that some polling station could be closed at 8 o'clock when there are still 200 people in line who want to vote, and that might get them angry, and that may cause some civil unrest. And will it now be possible for these soldiers to be deployed on November 4th to Cleveland or Denver or who knows where? This isn't trying to be alarmist or paranoid or anything like that. It's just, we're on the brink of this, and people need to be aware of it.
I truly am frightened by this prospect. It's not just the election that's coming up immediately, but we're now at the beginning of what looks like a real economic meltdown. And we knew the kind of social unrest we saw in the early 30s in the United States. There were general strikes in three cities in 1934, and it was that kind of social movement that brought about the little bit of progressive legislation that we got out of the New Deal. But with the army in the streets, it makes it all the more difficult, doesn't it, for people to express themselves.
Early last month, we saw what happened in Minnesota, where law enforcement authorities in mass went in and arrested protesters, reporters, and others, almost without any justification whatsoever.
Now, I understand, Steve, that training is underway in Fort Stewart, Georgia. Any
right.
other locations?
That's my understanding, that the training is going on in Georgia. NORTHCOM, the command under which they are serving now, is based in Colorado Springs, but they seem to be doing their training in Georgia. And that training is very interesting in itself. They're talking about, from the Army Times article that came out describing this, they're learning how to use the first ever non-lethal package that the Army has fielded. And what they consider non-lethal is the use of tasers, which have killed about 300 people in the United States since 2001 in use by law enforcement authorities. The commander of the brigade talked about how he was the first one in the brigade to get tasered, and he talked about it in a fun kind of way, as if it's all in good fun, talking about how it felt like the worst muscle cramp ever. These soldiers are being trained to use tasers and then will be sent out into the U.S. to control crowds.
They also have much more deadly weapons, a whole store of them that they have in storage, and they can bring those out if they need them. And the thing that alarmed me was this introduction of this fighting brigade from Iraq into our streets was done against the overt will of the governors of various states. I recently reread parts of Gibbon's great book, Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And Gibbons places the beginning of the decline and fall when the emperor Julius Caesar brought troops from way out in the countryside across the Rubicon, the river outside of Rome, and brought them into Rome and had the troops there in Rome that could be used at his command to suppress any kind of democratic uprising inside of Rome. What is your reaction to that in terms of an analogy about what the Bush people are doing in bringing these troops across our own Rubicon here in the United States?
It's an apt analogy, and this is just one more example. And the timing of it is just extremely disturbing. It would be disturbing at any point, but to intentionally have this plan and then to have it launched on October 1st, just 34 days or 35 days before a national election where George Bush could lose power and certainly should lose power.
Steve, does the American Freedom Campaign Action Fund have a website?
Yeah.
Can you share that with us, please?
Sure. It's AmericanFreedomCampaign.org.
Great. We've been talking with Steve Fox from the American Freedom Campaign Action Fund about the brigade that they're bringing over from Iraq to patrol American streets. An alarming development. Steve Fox, thank you so much for your good work and for your appearing on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you, Heidi.
Today we are witnessing not a Wall Street crisis, but a generalized crisis of capitalism. It's something that we've predicted over the years, and it's now happening. Why? Simply because people that produce things in this economy aren't paid enough to buy back what they produce. There's all kinds of surplus capital out there. It's not used for productive means, but it's become speculative capital. People haven't, in the United States, received an increase in real wages in almost 30 years. So we now have a collapse of this whole debt structure, and it's brought down insurance companies, banks, Wall Street banks, commercial banks, and it threatens to bring the economy of the United States, and in fact the economy of the world, because the United States is 25% of the world economy, to a grinding halt. We're joined by Professor Richard Wolff, who is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, in fact one-time chair of that department. He teaches in Massachusetts, as well as in the New York Marxist School, of which he's a board member. Professor Richard Wolff, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, glad to be here.
We're speaking with you after Congress ditched the first bailout proposal and before another vote is going to be taken. I want the audience to understand that. But pulling back from this specific, what they've called a crisis of Wall Street, Michael and I have read your articles and we'll post on our website. And you call it not so much a crisis of Wall Street, but a crisis of the capitalist system. And I wanted you to talk with respect to that. The critics of the bailout are calling it socialism for the rich. I think that's kind of a misuse of the term socialism. But my question to you is, what's going on? If you were to analyze it and project what you would call socialism for everybody who's not rich, what would you be for?
Well, let me first try to explain what I mean by calling it a crisis of capitalism. I am very distressed, to say the least, by the constant putting of the adjective financial in front of the word crisis. That is, a crisis we surely have, but limiting it to finance as if it were only there and had only peculiarly to do with banking and credit is really a terrible misunderstanding of what's going on. The financial system of the United States, money lending, credit, banking, all of that, is deeply embedded in and completely dependent on the rest of the economy, the production of goods and services by companies large and small and their distribution all over the place. And likewise, what happens in finance is not only dependent on what happens everywhere else, but vice versa. In other words, this is a crisis that would not have exploded in the financial sector had not the conditions for it been developing over decades everywhere in the economy, which is why even if the bill passes, that is the new bailout version that the Senate will vote on tonight and the House is expected to vote over the next 48 hours, even if it passes, this is probably an important contribution, but far short of what would be necessary because it is only about finance, it is only about the viability of banks. And that's simply too narrow a focus to deal with this problem.
What do you have to deal with, Rick?
You have to deal with the underlying causes. I mean, to give you a snapshot picture, for 150 years, from 1820 to 1970, the American economy, uniquely in the world, delivered to most of its workers a rising standard of living. Their wages went up every decade for those 150 years, and they used that money to buy more things, which is one of the reasons why Americans are so much more consumption-focused than people almost anywhere else on the earth. They were able to develop that feeling about measuring their own self-worth in terms of what they could consume because they were safe in doing that since each generation was able to consume at a higher standard than the one before. America came to be thought of as unique and special. Immigrants from around the world came here for a very good reason. And then in the 1970s, this culture, so focused on consumption, paid for out of rising wages, suddenly discovered itself in a new situation. For the last 30 years, the real wages of American workers did not go up. That is a fundamental shift in a society that affects every worker, whether he or she makes bed sheets or hamburgers, that is not at all specially related to finance, but it's a fundamental shift. And when the American working people, who had come to measure and expect rising standard of consumption, could no longer afford that with the wages that they got from the hours that they worked, they reacted as people might expect. They worked more hours, and they borrowed the money that was necessary to get into a position to afford more consumption. And right there is the first beginning of what we now have, a population that is increasingly paying for rising consumption by exhausting themselves in hours of work and taking on ever more debt. Look at it from the point of view of the workers, or if you do, you see exhaustion and anxiety. You see 30 years of working people in circumstances that make their lives strained, pressurized, that undercut their feelings for one another. They're exhausted. They're worried. Of course, our family values fall apart. Of course, our rates of divorce go crazy. Of course, our dependence on legal and illegal drugs zooms. We are a population whose families under extraordinary pressure. And let me just say the other side of it. For business, everything was wonderful. Even as for the mass of the working people, everything got terrible. Think about 30 years during which every year American workers became more productive. The last 30 years are the age of the computer. Everybody could produce more goods and services because he or she was working with a computer. They produced more each year, but their wages never went up.
Why didn't wages go up despite the increase in productivity since the 1970s? I think that's key, isn't it?
Right. There are several factors that came together to make this fantasy of the business community come true. First, with the globalization of high-tech and transportation and communication, American corporations began in their competition not only with one another, but with the resurgence of Europe and Japan, having recovered from World War II by the 1970s. With all of this going on and the rising of competition, American corporations began to need to find cheaper workers. And to make a long story short, they moved out of the United States because it was profitable to do so. And that left workers here without work. And the unemployed workers who left behind when the corporations moved abroad began to compete with those who were still working by offering to work less. Wages, therefore, don't rise. Number two, we brought in waves of immigrants, having not done so for several decades, and they came in for a whole host of reasons, and they competed for jobs. And women, because the family wage wasn't going up with the husband, the women went out to work in order to build up the family's capacity to keep consuming, and so they competed for jobs. Plus, a new computer substituted machines for jobs. So when you put all of that together, the immigrants, the women, the machines, and the export or outsourcing of jobs, wages stopped rising.
Now, Rick, the one thing that I think if I were a listener here, I would say, well, are you saying you're blaming immigrants for the fact that wages didn't go up, or you're blaming women? Is that what's going on here?
It's not a question of blaming. It's a question of understanding why these things happened. Absolutely, it is the case that you suddenly had, in the language of economics, a fall in the demand for American workers because corporations were leaving for cheaper workers outside, and you had a rise in the supply of workers because of immigration, because of women. If you put those factors together, and especially if you understand that the women were entering the labor force partly because they had to maintain the family standard of living. And the immigrants had to come here because they had to, since the United States, interacting with this country's economies from which they came, left them no choice.
The problem that I'm having is you're making me think that the solution here is to kick out all the immigrants.
Well,
and I'm not sure that's where you want to go here.
No, that's certainly not where I want to go, but it is an important thing for you to say because you can be very sure that there will be major social forces in the United States who will take advantage of the current crisis to come up with exactly that kind of solution.
If that's not the solution, what are the solutions?
Yeah, Professor Richard Wolff, you're a Marxist economist at the University of Massachusetts. You obviously don't buy this extravagant bailout of Wall Street. You've got your own ideas on what should be done. If we had our own political organization and we were running Rick Wolff for president and you were in the debate, what would you say we should do tomorrow to help the economy and to help everybody but not the rich?
Well, what I would begin by saying is if you have a problem that has built up over all these years in the ways that I tried to sketch, you're not going to solve it in the ways that are being proposed now, neither by extreme right-wing anti-immigration moves or by trying to force women back out of the labor force into the household. The reason you're not going to see that last or even develop very far is none of those proposals will work. The women will not go back. The families will not give up their consumption. The immigrants can't go back from where they came. The economies there couldn't cope with it, et cetera, et cetera.
What about giving $700 billion to the investment banks?
Yeah, that's a quick fix in order to relieve the immediate pressure. It doesn't solve the underlying problem. Let me try to get at it in a slightly different way. if you look at the American economy today, there are many problems that are not being given attention because of all the focus on finance. Every major retailer of clothing, of furniture, of cars is cutting back. The layoffs are beginning. There is a broad, what we call in economics, recession underway. There is no stopping it at this point. You have a major cutback, and it's globalized so that every part of the world is cutting back, which feeds in and does it to everyone else. Therefore, the kind of general solution I'm about to sketch for you is a response to the reality and not a response to this fictionalized focus on finance as if it could do the problem. We need a fundamental reorganization of the American economic system. At the base, let me sketch what it might look like. We have to put Americans into jobs that pay them a wage that is going to go up with whatever extra productivity they can achieve. The only way to do that, and therefore to stop the cascading mountains of debt that workers got into, the very debt that then stimulated banks to compete with one another to get their hands on the profits from that debt, producing a spiral of financial mismanagement and risk-taking that's collapsing all around us now. The fundamental change has to be to make it no longer necessary for workers to rely on debt, to put them in a position so that the government, together with the working people, can organize the economic system in a way that serves their needs and reduces the banking community and so on to the kind of secondary adjuncts of a functioning economy that they were supposed to be and that they can be once again. But this is not going to be done by the people who run the corporations of the United States. The name of that group is called the Board of Directors. Every corporation, whether it has 10 employees or it has a million employees like Walmart, is governed by a small group of people, 15 to 25 individuals, who are members of a board of directors. They are used to being in positions of power. They make decisions in classical ways. They've been doing that for 150 years. There is where the change has to begin. The need in this society is to make the organization and the decisions of corporations, who do most of the business in this society, run to a different tune, work in a different way. And that's not going to be achieved if we rely on the old existing structures manned by the same old existing groups. So my basic proposal is that we reorganize our businesses, that we change the way a business works so that the people who depend on it most, the people who work there, become their own board of directors. What we need to do is to do what most Americans in their fantasy already say they want. If you ask college students in America, or high school students, what would you like to be 5 years from now when you finished your education and you want a job? Two-thirds of them say, I want to be my own boss. I think that's a brilliant insight. Corporations could be reorganized so that the workers in them become, collectively, their own boss. Here's how it would be working. Monday to Thursday, you come and you do your job, as you always did. You make software, you make shirts, you make hamburgers, you sell music, whatever it is. On Friday, you come to work, but your work is very different. You sit around in meetings and you decide what is to be produced, what is to be done with the profits, how are they to be used to build your jobs and to build your communities. You're going to care about your communities because you are the people who live in the communities half the time. You only work half the time. So for the first time, the people who make the business decisions will be the communities who have to live with the results of those decisions. The basic principle of running a business in this way is a principle to which we usually give the name democracy. It is the government of the economic institution by the people who depend on it, rather than creating the production system in such a way that a handful of people, the bosses, are set against the mass of people who work there in a conflicted situation that periodically makes one or the other or both of them behave in antagonistic ways which destroy the whole community, which is where we are now.
Rick, here, I'm sitting here listening to this, and I understand that. And what concerns me a bit here is it's a fantasy at this point in our lives. And maybe, of course, we have to fight for those kind of goals and fight for what's right. But in the end, the idea of essentially having workers control all these major businesses and small businesses, at least it doesn't seem very realistic to me. We're not even close to that in a laissez-faire capitalist system. The most I could say if I were looking at it as a non-economist is we're going to go back to more of a regulated economy like we did in the 30s. And yes, in 30 more years, it'll be undone again. And maybe we have the long-term goal that you have. But if you were asking someone, isn't that what you would have to say? Don't we need we need more regulation now. It's not going to solve the problem. It'll at least go somewhere.
How do you transition to that? That's what we're asking you.
But I would ask you to think of that. The question might be a little bit different. If we had been talking here, you and I, 6 months ago, we would have said that anyone who described the situation we're in now was living in a fantasy world. It might one day happen, but we're not about to see the literal disintegration of, for example, the basic structure. There are no more investment banks. 6 months ago, the investment banks were the most profitable institutions in the society. If I had said to you then, they'll all be gone. There will no longer be an investment bank. Half of them will have collapsed and the other half will have been in such terrible shape that they will have been merged with other things. You would have thought I was nuts.
I would have. I had read Ernest Mandel. I thought that this speculative capital madness was going to crash.
We would have thought there was a 10% chance. And if you read the book The Black Swan, when you look at it in retrospect, looking at it from back then, there was a 10 or 15% chance by people who really thought about it.
Good, good. That's where I was going. You're saving me time. I want you to think about the 10 or 15% chance that there will be people who are not willing at this point to resume a struggle for reforms that we just had 30 years of illustration of them being undone. And keep in mind, not only will there be large numbers of workers who are not going to be moved by this, who will remember that even under the time of regulation from the 1930s to the 1970s, that their condition wasn't all that good, that in the end, many workers voted for Reagan, switched over from the Democrats because they felt betrayed, that the hope and the dream of that reformed capitalism was turning into its opposite, and they were angry about it. Keep also in mind that we have now boards of directors that have a 35-year history, at least, of learning wonderful techniques to evade reforms, to undo reforms, to rewrite reforms. Lobbying is developed on a new scale. In point of fact, the option of regulating capitalism in the way we did before is very dubious because the people who supported it last time will support it less this time. And the people who opposed it are now geniuses at how to undo it and avoid it. It's not a workable solution. For America, the response to re-regulation is really a sigh and the comment, been there, done that. And in fact, if the left in America wants to have a chance to solve this problem rather than to repeat the sorry history of the last 40 years, which in the history of the American left is a period of uninterrupted decline, then they have to come up with a new analysis and a new target and a new program. Otherwise, their chances of influencing will continue to be as marginal as they are now.
So let me ask you a bottom line question, Rick Wolf. Are you supporting the bailout that's being supported by both the Republican and the Democratic Party, by both McCain and Obama? Do you support that bailout?
Yes. Let me tell you why. Is it a solution to the problem? Absolutely not. Is it unfair? Absolutely it is. But you're in a situation in which this system is grinding to a halt. The level of contradictions and conflicts and self-interested hoarding of money by banks is literally bringing this system to its knees. And capitalism is nothing if not a system that has well-worked-out mechanisms for making sure that any economic problem that is encountered is shifted by the people at the top to the people at the bottom. Those in the greatest danger from the economic collapse that is now happening around us are the two-thirds of the people at the bottom of our society. Workers, unemployed, housewives, students, retirees, that's who's going to take it on the chin as this system unfolds. And I believe, absent a strong, organized left of the sorts even that you have in European countries, the tendency for folks under the kinds of pressure that are now threatening us in our culture is to move to the right, not the left. We need to have a situation that is not so dire that the possibility for political work, for education, for people to understand not only what the problems are, but the kinds of new solutions I've tried to suggest, that we have the time and the space in which to put those forward. If we don't, if we flail around in our rage and our frustration by mumbling things about fat cats and greedy people and those at the top have made a fortune, and they will be fine as this system goes down. It's the rest of us that are at risk, and I don't want that to happen because I think that is politically dangerous, and I am sure that I can explain, which I've been doing on radio, television, and more talking like this than I've done in the past 20 years in the last month, I am sure that when you explain that to working people, they understand.
Professor Rick Wolf at the University of Massachusetts. Rick Wolf, thank you very, very much for your thoughtful comments on what you've called this crisis, not of Wall Street, but a crisis of capitalism.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. This is the kind of educational work that your program is doing that is the most important thing to make there be a chance to come out of this crisis with a real advance for most Americans rather than a catastrophe.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Go now to hear excerpts from speeches held at Luis Posada Carriles, a tribunal, at New York University Law School. Speakers included Jane Franklin, historian and author, Wayne Smith, senior fellow from the Center for International Policy, and Brian Becker, director of the Answer Coalition. The event was moderated by our own Michael Stephen Smith. We go now to hear an excerpt from Jane Franklin's talk that night. Let's have a listen.
Delightful to be here to talk about Luis Posada Carriles. This tribunal should be being held in a court of law because Luis Posada is the most notorious terrorist in the Western Hemisphere at this time. Yesterday was the anniversary of the bombing of the Flight 455 that killed 73 people when it blew up and fell into the sea off Barbados on October 6, 1976, killing all 73 people aboard. And yesterday, Guyanese, because there were Guyanese on board, Venezuelans, because some of the people on board had come from Venezuela heading for Cuba, Cubans, and also Barbadians, because it crashed off Barbados, met together in Barbados to lay a wreath at the monument that the Barbados government had built in memory of those victims. And they were all wondering why the United States continues to harbor a terrorist like Luis Posada. Everyone knows he's guilty. After 9/11, George Bush said that anybody who harbors a terrorist is a terrorist. But in this case, he's not about to bring Luis Posada to trial. Washington won't do that for several reasons. One is that Luis Posada, through his lawyer, has said that if he's put on trial, he will tell all the secrets he knows about the CIA and the government. The other is that Luis Posada is part of a private army created by the CIA that can be called upon whenever they're needed. And the CIA is not about to get rid of that private army. To understand why and how this situation exists, we need to go back to the roots of U.S.-Cuba relations, back past 1959 when the revolutionaries seized power, back past 1776 when the 13 colonies declared independence and defeated the British Empire, back to the time when the 13 colonies and Cuba were all subject to the twin oppressors of slavery and colonialism. No sooner had the 13 colonies created the United States of America than the United States began its own march toward empire. And I'll read something from 1809. Former President Jefferson writes to his successor, James Madison, quote, "I candidly confess that I have ever looked upon Cuba as the most interesting addition that can be made to our system of states. With Cuba and Canada," he says, "we should have such an empire for liberty, as she has never surveyed since the creation." Then a few years later, 1823, comes the quintessential statement of U.S. policy toward Cuba. This remains the policy toward Cuba. Having acquired East and West Florida from Spain a few years earlier, the United States has expanded to within 90 miles of Cuba. Secretary of State John Quincy Adams describes the likelihood of U.S. annexation of Cuba within half a century. They didn't quite make it by then, despite obstacles. Quote, "There are laws of political as well as of physical gravitation, and if an apple severed by the tempest from its native tree cannot choose but fall to the ground, Cuba, forcibly disjoined from its own unnatural connection with Spain and incapable of self-support, can gravitate only towards the North American Union." And the Cubans call this la fruta madura. The United States, that is, the ripe fruit. The United States would wait until the fruit was ripe for picking, and it decided it was in 1898, when, after 3 years of fighting, the Cuban revolutionaries were virtually defeating Spain, which was a dying empire. That started out in 1895, led by Jose Martí, who unfortunately was killed right away. But Spain was ready to cede Cuba to the revolutionaries when the United States intervened and declared war on Spain in April of 1898. Spain surrendered in August, 4 months only. When they went to the Paris Treaty talks, Havana was not even allowed there, and the U.S. flag, not the Cuban flag, went up over Havana. The United States came out of that war with four new territories, Guam and the Philippines for the Navy in the West in the Pacific, and Puerto Rico and Cuba for the Navy in the Atlantic and the Caribbean. The United States was building a Navy. A Navy is part of conquest. A Navy means aggression, and those four ports were for expanding the empire. That's in our history books as the Spanish-American War, because it was a war beyond Cuba. But in Cuba, it's called the U.S. intervention in their second war of independence, because Washington simply snatched victory out of their arms and occupied Cuba for 4 years, a crucial period in U.S.-Cuba relations, of course. When the United States agreed to take the troops out in 1902, they agreed only on condition that the Platt Amendment be put into the Cuban Constitution, which had basically been written in Washington. The Platt Amendment was already a U.S. law, and it gave Cuba, I mean the United States, virtual control of the island, including the right to intervene militarily at any point considered in U.S. interest, not Cuban interest, but U.S. interest, and including the territory that became the Guantanamo Naval Base and now holds the notorious prison at Guantanamo. This situation of leaving Cuba exactly on May 20th, 1902, is considered by Cuban right-wingers in Miami as Independence Day for Cuba. But really, the colony had been created, had been transformed from Spain to a neo-colony of the United States. And so the Cubans who wanted more revolution, more independence, do not consider May 20th, 1902, Independence Day. But the Comprador class does consider it Independence Day. And that Comprador class is the class that is the wealthy element of the Cuban-American community in Miami and in New Jersey. They still would like to be back to what it was in 1902, 1950s, and so on. The situation went through many, many struggles, dictatorships, Machado dictatorship, and so on. In 1940, the Cubans managed to write a second constitution and put that into effect. There were elections every 4 years, 44, 48, 52. In 52, General Batista overthrew the government, canceled the elections, suspended the Constitution, and established a dictatorship. The dictatorship, of course, welcomed casinos and welcomed corporations like Firestone, where Luis Posada worked as a supervisor. And Firestone has a record of cruelty to its workers. Last year in Liberia, there was a scandal involving child labor at Firestone. So you can imagine what the conditions were like in the 50s with Posada as one of the supervisors of Firestone. On January 1st, 1959, the revolutionaries seized power. Foreigners owned 75% of the arable land, 90% of services like water and electricity, and 40% of the sugar industry. The first Agrarian Reform Act, as Michael was mentioning, was passed in May 1959 because all of this ownership had to be changed. There had to be a redistribution of wealth. So Allen Dulles and John Foster Dulles in the White House, the head of the CIA and the State Department secretary, went into Eisenhower and discussed invasion, and they started training Cuban emigres to invade Cuba. They had overthrown the Guatemalan government in 1954 in 3 days, and they thought they could do the same in Cuba. Posada fled Cuba in 1960 and joined the people who were planning to invade Cuba. The invasion, instead of winning in 3 days, was defeated in 3 days, and the state of siege was begun with overt and covert operations. Overt included the travel ban that started in January 1961 before the invasion. They couldn't have people going down there and then invade. The invasion was still secret. The trade embargo was established, a full embargo, in February of 1962, and that was part of the plans for another invasion, which led directly but secretly to the October Missile Crisis that year. We only found out about that plan for that invasion in 1975. The covert operations started with very early in 1959. Assassination plans in 1960 involved the mafia, the invasion in 1961, and constant terrorism after the invasion failed. After that invasion, Posada and many other Cuban emigres were trained at Fort Benning by the CIA. And Posada told the New York Times in 1998, "The CIA taught us everything, everything. They taught us explosives, how to kill, bomb, trained us in acts of sabotage. The CIA turned those men into killers and saboteurs. Posada was only part of a network of terrorists. And I wanted to read you just a couple of sentences about the kind of training, the degree of training. From 1963 through 1966, E. Howard Hunt works out of a CIA station housed at the University of Miami with the code name JM Wave. About 30 employees, like Hunt, CIA agents, control a few thousand Cuban agents. So those were thousands of people being trained to overthrow the Cuban government. We need to think about what that meant toward Cuba. Cuba knew this was happening. We didn't know, most people here did not know. Cuba knew this was happening. I have a flyer which is available here listing a partial list of the terrorist organizations in Cuba, and I hope you will take that before you leave, those of you who don't have it. It's an amazing piece of paper. I mean, I kept it to one page. There were many other organizations, terrorist organizations. Posada moved to Venezuela, where he became head of counterintelligence. He moved there in 1967, and later on, when they let him go from counterintelligence, he set up his own security company. Now, at some point, 1976, Posada was let go from the CIA roles, and you see people asking, why? What did he do? Why did they let him go? Well, people evidently have not noticed a strange coincidence of chronological facts. In 1975, the Senate Intelligence Committee held hearings which were amazingly informative, amazingly. It's all in the congressional record. They were investigating the CIA's illegal activities both here in the United States and abroad. The anti-war movement here had created a knowledge about what the CIA was doing. The Senate Intelligence Committee was investigating that in depth. Many assassinations against Fidel Castro, of course, were uncovered. But of course, the assassination of Lumumba and other leaders around the world was also uncovered. So in 1976, when they were about to release their report, which would obviously demand that the CIA stop assassinating people here and abroad, the Ford administration wanted to know what to do because they didn't want to still be having these assassins on their payroll. So in Posada's case, for instance, on February 13th, he was taken off the rolls. The CIA turned their assassination business over to private enterprise. Posada was now a free agent to do what he wanted. He had plenty of money behind him, of course, with the multimillionaires in Miami and New Jersey. And he had CIA support behind his back. He told the New York Times he never lost that. That was always there. And he had his friends in the FBI. And 5 days later, after he was let go, and I'm sure other people were let go, came the executive order from President Ford to the CIA saying no more assassinations. So he was let go, but he was kept as a freelance assassin in June. And so what did all these people do who were let go by the CIA? In June, Orlando Bosch and Luis Posada, another terrorist, founded KORU, an organization devoted to terrorism against Cuba and any institutions and individuals considered friendly to Cuba. 50 bombs they set off in the last 6 months of that year. Some of them had something to do with killing Orlando Letelier, the Chilean official on the streets of Washington in a car bomb, along with Ronnie Muffet, his assistant. And then came the most horrible of the attacks, the massacre of those 73 people in October. Now, the Barbadian police and the Trinidadian police did wonderful work and arrested two bombers right away, and they led, those bombers led to Luis Posada and Juan Bosch right away. So they were arrested, along with two or three other people. But to make that story short, Posada escaped, went to Central America, carried out terrorist activities all over Central America for years, including a rampage of bombings in Honduras against the president of Honduras. He was thrown out of Honduras as a result. In 1997 and 1998, he orchestrated bombing campaigns against tourist sites in Havana. The bombs were set in restaurants and hotels, aimed at the tourism industry, which had become the mainstay of the Cuban economy after the disintegration of the Soviet Union. So this is where you have Cuba having to use its own agents to find out what's going on in this country among the terrorists who are making their plans to attack Cuba. They had gathered a lot of information, and they gave reams of that information to the FBI in 1998. Well, the FBI, instead of arresting the terrorist, arrested the Cubans who had gathered the information. And that's how the Cuban Five came to be tried, convicted, and put in various prisons all over this country. You've got them in five different prisons. Rene Gonzalez in Florida, Ramon Labanino in Kentucky, Fernando Gonzalez in Indiana, Antonio Guerrero in Colorado, and Gerardo Hernandez in California. Five different prisons they've been in for 10 years now. But that did not stop Cuban agents from finding out about terrorist activities. And the most important one, perhaps, was in 2000, when Fidel Castro arrived in Panama for the Ibero-American Summit. He held a press conference and announced to the press and to the police and to the people there that Luis Posada was in town with three other notorious terrorists, all of whom are wandering around in Miami now. And they were planning to kill him that night by blowing up plastic explosive in the auditorium where Fidel Castro was planning to speak. So, of course, the police had to go arrest these people. The Cuban agents even knew what motels they were in. And they were arrested, tried on minor charges, and put in jail on a prison on minor charges. Nothing about the assassination, and the whole reason for that is absurd, but I won't go into that here. That night, 2,000 people listened to Fidel Castro speak, and they weren't blown up. Now imagine if the agents had not gotten that information and had not interfered with that plan. What carnage there would have been. So the Cuban agents that do this are true heroes, and they don't just save Cuban lives. In Miami, terror has been legitimized by the government and normalized by the culture. Luis Posada snuck back into the United States in 2005, and he's welcomed by the right-wing Cubans in Miami, celebrated. He told a dinner in his honor in May, "We need to sharpen our machetes. The end is near. We're very near winning. Just sharpen your machetes and be ready." And this is what we need to study and understand, not just in order to understand why there's this network of terrorists that roams free in our country, but to understand the ramifications and the consequences of our policy toward Cuba. Thank you.
That was Jane Franklin speaking at Luis Posada Carriles, a tribunal at New York University Law School. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.